All right, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and whenever you are, you're on the Asian Highway. Welcome back to the Storytellers of Action podcast. Today is September 5th. This is season 5, episode 5, so we got a 5-5-5 for you. Welcome back. This is your host, Pimo. Today I'm rolling solo. Godspeed to Dibesh Das and Feral Khan for whatever they're up to today, and we'll have them back next week. We have a very special guest talking to us today. Her name is Pin Chen. She is the president and founder of Crescendo Young Musicians Guild. She's also a youth orchestra conductor, and she also is a school director for music. We'll talk to her about all this stuff plus a few more things as well. So let's first welcome in Pin. Hello.
Hi. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Thanks for coming on. So let's just dive right into the music. You are a violinist. Let's start before we get to the education stuff and music education. Let's start how you got music. What was it about the violin? What was it about music that kind of drew you to it?
So music was sort of my fate and my destiny. My dad's family was all very musical. There were four brothers, and all four of them got into music in some way, shape, or form. Mm-hmm. My grandpa was very much a connoisseur of music, even though he wasn't. So my dad was my first violin teacher. So he started me off on the violin when I was 6 years old and kind of went from there. I actually before that, I started singing solos in choir at church, like when I was three. And apparently I would like to stand in front of the choir while my dad was rehearsing them and start conducting them. I started violin when I was 6 years old and piano when I was seven. Then when I got into high school, I also did percussion and basically just dove into everything music. I started teaching private violin lessons when I was 14 years old, and really enjoyed that. And that's basically when I decided, hey, you know what? I like playing, but I think I like teaching even better.
So when did the teaching officially start? I mean, you know, you've been doing music for a while. Was it, you know, towards the end of high school and college? When did you realize, like, this is something I have to do, and you start executing?
So I basically, after I started teaching the private lessons, I decided I wanted to be a music teacher, like a public school music teacher, because as I was in high school, I started getting into marching band and orchestra. So I was like concert master and drum major, all of that stuff. So I tried to do as much as I could. Props to my high school music director, Jocelyn Blaisdell. She basically saw that that's what I wanted to do and just gave me as many opportunities as possible. And my senior year, I even got a chance to basically just take an entire piece from beginning to end, from, you know, sight reading to rehearsing them every day and getting to conduct it in the concert. That was a really valuable experience. So I went to Northwestern University and got my Bachelor of Music degree there in Instrumental and General Music Education and started teaching right after college. So when I was 22.
Wow. So pretty much most of your adult life, you've been doing this.
Pretty much. Yeah. I live and breathe it.
Nice. So let's transition quickly now into some of the education stuff. So you're the president and founder of a music guild. So tell us how that started. What's the mission? How do you work with the youth? Walk us through that whole process.
Sure. So I am not necessarily a music or a business-minded person. And I found out pretty quickly that running and starting a nonprofit is business. So I'm not a huge fan of that. However, it's something that I'd always thought about in the back of my head, is really providing a space for students of all socioeconomic backgrounds to be able to come together and serve the community that way. So Crescendo Young Musicians Guild is something I started in about 2011, and we really started running our programs in 2012. And at the time, I was teaching for Los Angeles Unified School District, and they were making all sorts of budget cuts. and they were, of course, when there are budget cuts in the school system, they like to call, you know, cut the arts. They cut music programs. And so they were cutting a bunch of stuff. And I just was like, you know what, this is a good time for me to go ahead and start something where students who don't have music programs in their schools can still have music instruction, but it needs to be affordable. And my philosophy has always been that every child deserves a quality music education, period. There are more well-off kids that can get their private lessons, or if they live in a better neighborhood, they might have a really good, you know, school music education program. But there are tons of kids who, while I was teaching at LA Unified, especially, you know, I was teaching high school, and I saw these kids that actually they really had a lot of talent and a lot of potential, but they just got started way too late. And, you know, they're like, oh, Miss Chen, I want to major in music. This would be really cool. And in the back of my head, I'm like, that's awesome, but you are 10 years behind most other people trying to compete with them to get into music school. Like, I you're talented, but that's not going to happen right now. And it just broke my heart to know that these kids were in this position. And so that's why I started Crescendo Young Musicians Guild.
Okay. And it's interesting, you know, you talk about, you know, public schools, and, you know, one thing, you know, I hear a lot about, I think it's out there a lot, is STEM education, you know, STEM. And I rarely see the alternative of that, or the expanded version of that, which is STEAM, you know, STEAM, right? And that still be science, technology, engineering, arts, and math, right? Mm-hmm. Would that be, so,
yeah.
Yeah, and so I would love to, me personally, I would love to see more of the A, the STEAM. So I guess the question to you is, how can we make STEAM more of a thing? What kind of situation would we have to have where the arts isn't the first thing that's cut when we have budget cuts?
That's a great question. You know, the thing is, a lot of the policymakers and the people who control the budgets, they, a lot of times, aren't even in education. They're just politicians, right? And they don't have the background. So they have no idea what being in the classroom is like and what kids actually need. And especially for those kids that are more at risk, that have the lower test scores, all they think is that, you know what, then we need to give them more math. We need to give them more English because that's what they suck at, right? And what they're not looking at is the bigger picture of the whole child, which is that, you know what, arts actually helps them. And especially with music and learning a musical instrument, I mean, the rewiring of the brain, and, you know, playing a musical instrument is one of the few things, if not the only things in life that you do that engages both sides of your brain at the same time. You know, if you do, you know, math, that's the left side of your brain, but that's it, you know, and English still left side of your brain. But if you're actually training the brain to activate and you know, you've probably heard about these research studies that have been done, and they've even stuck a person, you know, a violinist in the MRI machine and tried to see what kind of, you know, brain activity is going on while they're playing. I mean, it's incredible. The whole thing just lights up. And that's what we need, is for the kids to be able to train their brains that way, and, you know, improves their memory function, their cognitive ability. I think I'm preaching to, you know, the choir here with you at least, but definitely, you know, we need to give kids the opportunity to be able to expand their horizons. But, you know, if we want to be able to not have arts be cut, there just needs to be more advocacy on the part of arts organizations and teachers, and more input really from teachers themselves to say, and that, you know what, we really need to look at the whole kid. You can't just put band-aids on everything and expect it to be okay, because you have to approach it from a different angle.
100% agree. And, you know, I definitely want to say you are preaching to the choir. I do want to add one interesting comment. You made something that was, you made a statement which I resonate with, which really resonated with me. And is that, you know, a lot of these policymakers are politicians. They're not in the classroom. And it's sadly, that's not just an education thing. I mean, you know, me being a journalist, I see plenty of situations where I cover agencies. I cover, you know, government organizations where the people who are at the dais making decisions have no real connection to the industry or area that they're mandating policy for. It could be something like fishing or water or anything really. And a lot of these agencies become kind of a stepping stone to other political positions. And what happens because of that, you have a lot of seats that are filled by people who with political ambition, but they're not in the industry that they're mm-hmm. regulating.
Oh, yeah. I mean, absolutely. I mean, well, prime example, of course, is Betsy DeVos.
Right.
She has no freaking business being in that position. She's never been a teacher. Her kids have never been in public education. No idea. All she knows is money and for-profit enterprises. That's it.
Right.
There. So right. Why should a person like her be making policies on education for millions and millions of children?
Doesn't 100% and that's a big part of I think part of the failing of our system in general is we see that across the board, education, environment, whatever it is that's out there, it's a lot of people who don't have the background they need to be mandating the policies that affect everybody. Mm-hmm. So 100% agree with you there. I guess let's then talk about the current political climate then. I mean, I would make the statement it's more today's world, it's more necessary than ever to have music in our space. You basically alluded to this to show the benefits of having music education. What's the conversation to be had with people who don't quite get it? How do you specifically explain the need and the significance of music in education?
I think it kind of goes back to what I was saying before, which is the advocacy portion of it. You know, there is plenty of research out there. And for those who do still care about science and research, providing that kind of evidence, the hard evidence of, you know what, if there's these kids, we did a you know, 15-year study on them, and these kids had music education when they were young, and these kids did not. And what is their achievement level in terms of their grades, in terms of their career, even how much money they're making now? I mean, it's sad, but you know, a lot of our society is based on, you know, success centered on how much money you're making, and that's how our government functions, right? That's we're always talking about the stock market and businesses and whatnot. So if we want to talk money, fine, let's talk about money. How much money do people who have taken music lessons make compared to those who don't? I don't have the hard numbers on those, but I do know that there are lots of doctors and lawyers who still play music to this day. And and to the point where I was just showing my students this the other day as an activity, as one of my lessons. And there are many, many medical orchestras around the country. And they are basically, you know, community orchestras that are made up entirely of medical professionals, doctors, nurses, and what have you. And they still play at almost a professional level. It's incredible. And they do this for fun. because they, you know, they have their main career, but they're still doing this thing because it keeps them sane. It keeps them their brains activated. It keeps their creativity sort of alive. And these are doctors and lawyers that just do this on their free time. And there are actually a lot of, you know, big time CEOs out there as well, that have made statements about, you know what, I learned how to manage this company. I learned how to manage people and work with people through my music education, working with, you know, my section members in band, in orchestra, because, being able to work together as a team that way is how they develop those skills. And that's a huge part of why I am a high school music teacher, is because, you know, I have a team of student leaders, you know, the orchestra council basically, and they all have different jobs. And I tell them like, hey, you know what, this is in the context of orchestra. And I know that most of you are not going to be music majors, and I'm totally cool with that. I understand that. But that's not why we're here, right? We're not here to make you into professional musicians. Some of you, okay, maybe, but mostly I'm here to use music as a vehicle to teach you life skills. Skills that you're going to use later on in life to make you successful. And so that's how we kind of have to go about it, is making the point that in order to make students more successful in the future, in their lives, music is what's going to get them there.
So I totally understand the management, the way you explained that, you know, the working in teams and the lessons that could learn, that could be taken from there. That 100% makes sense to me. So my next question is a question of ignorance. And so I'm looking for enlightenment from you on this. So is there another layer of education here where individually, I mean, you know, the group and the management is one thing, but for the individual person, the science of music, because there is, I believe, at least I understand it to be, and you could, if I'm wrong, please tell me, but there's kind of a math or a science to music. And if is that true for one? And if so, how could the mastery of that aspect of music actually help grow the brain?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So when it comes to the science of music and how it kind of affects the brain, so music, if you think about rhythm, so I don't know how much you know about rhythm in terms of music. It's actually all very mathematical. So there are things called like time signatures, for instance. So like, you know, one music is at least Western classical music, is divided into measures. So for instance, most things are in 4/4 time. So you'll have four beats in a measure, right? And when we teach about rhythm, you can say like, okay, all right, so 1/4 note is equal to one beat. So how many quarter notes do you fit into one measure? Okay, that's four. You're just doing math right now. And then, okay, all right, half notes. Those are half of a quarter note. And you're gonna count them 1 and 2 and 3 and 4 and. Okay, how many eighth notes did you just play just now? Oh, cool. All right. Well, you can also do triplets, right? So to divide each one of those quarter notes into threes. And now you're basically able to not only process what those fractions are, but you're able to play them. So there's a practical application to this math. It's not just in your brain, in your head. That's just fractions. and that's rhythm. Essentially. And there's, of course, you know, broader applications for that as well. You're looking at the form and the structure of a particular piece and analyzing that. And that actually even also has to do, sometimes I have to equate that with English, with stories. You know, I'm like, where is the climax of this piece? Right. And that's kind of like a story, right? That is, English teachers teach this all the time. You know, you've got this introduction, you've got this denouement, you know, how do things resolve? And it's after that pinnacle, right? After you've reached that peak. And then there's a resolution to it. There's a coda. And again, it's all related to each other. But as far as like, activating your brain, you know, there's, with music, there's a lot of, there's a lot of memorization sometimes that's involved as well, especially if you're taking private lessons and you're working with a private teacher. More or less, you know, most private teachers will ask their students to memorize a piece. And that is actually, you're asking a lot of a student to not only be able to play the right note at the right time, play it in tune, play it with the right style. You have to use the right bowing direction, use the right part of the bow, attack the note with the correct technique, know how to shift at the right time. All of those things all at once, and you have to memorize it. I mean, that's a lot. And so I think for the argument sake of what music does for your brain, it's really hard to argue against it, honestly.
Well, I think you might have motivated me, to be honest, and I'll give you context of what I mean by that. So about 15 years ago, I started to take up a musical instrument. It's called a dhol, which is a big Indian drum.
Oh, nice.
And it's huge. I mean, I actually still have the drum in my house. I just don't use it. It probably weighs 30 or 40 pounds. And you kind of wear it on your body, and it's got two sticks. One stick, it plays the bass side. One stick plays the treble side. And I remember when I was taking lessons, it was very much to what you're describing, where it was pacing, it was memorizing, the beats were mathematically organized. And you have to memorize the math, the time when you're hitting the bass, when you hit the treble. You're doing the treble much more often than you're doing the bass. And so it's like this hand-eye coordination with your memory, all that stuff's in play. And the focus the focus you need just to play that, it's a very fun instrument to play. And it's a popular instrument at weddings, in certain kinds of Indian music. And it is really hard to play, despite being a simple instrument. It's a very simple instrument, but it's so hard to play.
Right.
But I think talking to you now, I think I'm too late to do this professionally, but just for fun, I might do it up again. So if I pick it up again, thank you.
Oh, hey, I hope so. And you know what? It's never too late. I mean, we're not talking just about kids, you know. Playing a musical instrument, it again has been scientifically proven to help fend off dementia and Alzheimer's, you know, because again, you are using your brain in ways that a lot of other things do not. There's like this huge market right now for all these like brain games and apps and stuff. And, you know, those are all good. Save yourself the money and staring at a screen all day. Just go and pick up an instrument, learn an instrument. It's not, I have taught adults as well, private lessons. I usually teach kids, but every once in a while, I'll get an adult that's like, you know what? I never had a chance to learn music, and I wish my parents had given me that opportunity. But now that I'm an adult, I'm going to do this. So can I still learn? Is it too late? No, it's never, ever too late. It's going to be a little harder, honestly, than if you were a little bit younger, but it's not too late. And it's just really good for you mentally, emotionally, and psychologically, really.
I kind of want to share an anecdote. You know, you were talking about, you know, about it not being too late. And that's definitely a theme in my life personally. And I heard something one day when I was driving on the radio. This was back when I was 19. I was a student in college and I was commuting. So I went to UCLA for college and I commuted from my home. It was about a 30-mile drive each way. And so, of course, I had a lot of time to listen to stuff on the radio because it's a long drive to Westwood. And it was an NPR episode, and this guy that was on this particular show was narrating a story. And the summary of the story was this: you're taught to go to school and get grades, that way get to a college, and then you go to college and pick the right major and get the good grades, get that first job, and then you go out and you date somebody, then you buy a house, and you get a job, and you get married, and then you have kids, and then you repeat the cycle all over again. Like, this is the process of life. And then you get to an age, 60, 70 years old, And you ask yourself, what about that book I want to write or that instrument I want to play? And I think that's so true in this context. What we're talking about is, you know, it's so easy to get caught up in what society tells you to do. Don't forget to do the things you want to do. And, you know, when you're talking about, I wish my parents had taught me, well, like you said, you know what, maybe that whatever happened in the past happened. It's not too late to pick up an instrument, you know, whatever that might be. For me, it might be the dhul, or it might be the other instrument I love, which is a saxophone. I'd love to learn either or both if I can, and I'll make an effort at some point. I definitely will. But you're 100% right. Is don't be afraid to say, you know what, I may be in my 40s or my 50s, so what? You know, start now. Because now is better than ever,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And you know, you're in it, and like you said, it might be harder to learn as an adult, but if you really want it, go and get it.
Yeah, yeah. And music is, I think, one of the greatest gifts in life. You know, it's one of the things that I think makes life worth living. And exactly what you just said, you know, we have this whole like, okay, you got to work to make money, and then you got to make money so that you can live. But, you know, what does living really mean? What part of living makes you happy? It's not just to survive, but you have to, you know, as they say, you know, you have to thrive, don't survive, thrive. And I think music is one of those things that is part of thriving.
And, you know, it's interesting because I to put this in, my mind thinks a lot of politics as well. So I'm going to phrase this politically in this context. I think it'll make sense when I'm done explaining it. When I see a lot of the arguments out there in the world right now on the campaign trails, I see a lot of that where people talk about, well, just survive. Let's focus on the things we need to survive. You know, like, let's just focus on, and I put this lightly, to focus on just bread and butter issues at the local level. Let's not worry about all these other things, right? And I almost wonder, like, why are we doing this to ourselves? Why are we saying, let's just focus on, I just make sure I have a job and I have food on the table, and who cares? Well, I should say who cares, but, you know, nothing else matters beyond that. So why are we wasting, quote unquote, money on other things when we should just be focusing on the bare bones bread and butter issue? And I'm kind of curious, is that something you also kind of observe? Is it just me that's seeing this? I'm just kind of curious your thoughts on all that, if that makes sense what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, sure, that it makes sense, obviously, like if you are hungry, right? And you have food to choose from, or you have music lessons to choose from. Okay, yeah, I mean, you kind of need food in order to survive, right? But to what degree do you need really, really great food? and there's, I mean, maybe that's a bad analogy, but there's the idea of, and I've seen this actually. I've taught at, again, you know, lower income schools, and the school that I'm teaching at now, there's a mix, but for the most part, people are pretty comfortable. And as far as the sort of capability for the kids and the families that I see to actually be happy, I don't see that big of a difference. And I think that in some ways, as people say, you know, more money, more problems, right? You know, when you have a little bit less to worry about money-wise, yeah, that's nice because you don't have to worry about money, but also you learn to appreciate the little things in life. And so if you're able to, you know, at least have the essentials. After that, I mean, I think you can survive and thrive on a lot less than you think you need. And so when people are talking about, yeah, okay, we got to make sure that we give everybody, you know, I think social programs, yes, those are necessary. And we need to make sure that people have access to healthcare, right? Because if you aren't healthy, then that's one of the things that obviously does not make you happy. But at the same time, you know, when you do get sick, after you get well, you also learn to appreciate the little things in life as well. So yeah, again, you have to look at the bigger picture.
Totally. And, you know, it's just, I think for me, it's just a matter of resources. And part of the beauty, maybe this is me being idealistic, I think part of the beauty of the United States is we actually do have the resources. It's just a matter of responsibly allocating them to where they belong. There's no reason why we can't have things beyond basic survival. I mean, because this is one of the things that we have as a country that we are. We are a rich country. We have the means to support arts and other things that might be luxuries, but they could exist here.
Absolutely. Oh yeah. I mean, the U.S. is very rich, and I think we see this all the time, is that money is being spent in the wrong places, and it pisses me off. When I was working for LA Unified, and that's a gigantor, you know, organization. It's I don't know if it's the largest school district in the nation. It's definitely in the top three. And it's huge. It's just, it's a monster. But I was really upset at seeing how they were spending money. And even like the superintendent, I think, was making, probably like $350,000 a year. Which I think at the time is like more than what the president of the United States made. Why? I mean, yes, it's a big job, but why? And it's not like they were even doing that good of a job, right? And then all the assistant superintendents, well over $200,000 each, right? And you think about what that can fund for the kids. And you know, you're spending it on like these flat screen TVs or what, like, why? I just don't understand. They're just spending money on the wrong things, I think, most of the time. And that's just in the education world. You know, as far as the government, right, we're looking at how much do you really need to spend on a fighter jet? Do we need that? Why? How many people can that feed? How much healthcare can that provide?
And I always say, you know, you look at the two parties, right? Democrats and Republicans, you know, I guess the fallacy is you'll hear from one side saying Democrats are about big government, Republicans are about small government. And I say that's bullshit. Because
absolutely.
Both parties are about big governments. It's about where the money gets spent, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm. Oh,
I mean,
totally.
Right? Democrats would, at least in theory, want to spend the money on social programs, whereas Republicans who want to spend the money on military and stuff like that. It's still big budget, no matter which way you go. It's just, where do you want that money to go? Really what it comes down to. So I laugh when I hear people talk about, you know, Republicans are about small fiscal conservative government. I'm like, no, you're not.
Yeah, I would consider myself a fiscal conservative, just because that's how I grew up. Like, I'm just naturally like a very frugal person. And so I want my government to be that way as well. Like, really, really be discerning about how you spend your money. And yeah, Republicans cannot make that argument any longer. You know, when I first, you know, turned 18 and I was, you know, registering for a party, I registered as Republican because that's what I believed in. You know, I was like, okay, it's smaller government, like, you know, we need to be fiscally conservative. And then eventually I realized, wait, they say that, but that's not really how they function. And now look at the deficit. Our deficit is out of control. So you cannot say that they are fiscally conservative. That is absolutely true. Like, you're saying, it's just BS. Absolute BS. And they're just not spending the money in a way that I think is responsible or helps the most number of Americans. And that's really what it's about, is that we need to kind of get back to the idea of really having government serve the people. And right now, that's not what's happening.
I don't know about you when you got out of college. From when I got out of college, and I graduated in 1998, at that time, the private sector was a place to be. The thought was, if you're leaving college to go work with the public sector, you're kind of doing a community service because the money just wasn't there, the career trajectory wasn't there. It was almost, I don't want to say shameful, but there was a slight stigma attached to going to government work back in the late, mid to late 90s. I don't see that. In fact, now fast forward 20, 25 years later, I almost see that it's went the other way, where you want a good cushy career, go work for the government, you know, because you're going to get a pension, you're going to get health care, you're going to get a nice steady salary. I mean, I don't know when this shift happened, but you cited a stat a few minutes ago about, hey, the LAUSD superintendent, which you're right, is one of the two or three biggest school districts in the country, if not the world, you know, pays its superintendent $300,000 a year. Who wouldn't want that salary?
Yeah.
Plus benefits, maybe plus a pension afterwards.
Yeah, right? No, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I don't know. And especially, right now in the federal government, we're seeing, you know, all the top positions are basically people who were already rich because they donated a bunch of money. And so because they were rich and donated a bunch of money, now they get to have these positions of power so that they can make decisions that will make them and their friends even richer. What is that? Like, I don't get it. That's not the government that we asked for.
Exactly. Like you said, it's not a government for the people, which is what it's meant to be. And so I kind of want to transition now to the election. And then after we talk about that, we'll talk about some of your acting stuff. You're also in acting. So let's quickly finish up about the election. And this is a broad question. And feel free to get as detailed as you want, you know, however comfortable you might feel. What's at stake for this election? Not just for the arts, but I guess for the soul of America. What's your take on what's the real decision that's in front of us?
So I'm going to put it out there. I mean, I don't think it's a surprise to say that I am voting for Biden in November. And I completely agree with, and I love his motto about, you know, this being an election for the soul of America. It really, really is. I think at this point we have to really dig deep and think about what are our values as Americans, as a nation. What is it that we really care about? And I know that the other side does say that, you know what, we don't really care what Trump says or, you know, how racist he is. What it comes down to is, well, he's going to put the right people in the right place. And so it doesn't really matter what his actions are. And I think 4 years ago, they could have made that argument, but we've seen what he's done in the last 4 years. This is not just about him being this puppet and then everybody else running the country for him. That's honestly what I thought, what my hope was when I, you know, after election night in 2016, after I cried, of course, and I was like, you know what? Okay, fine. Maybe it won't be that bad. Maybe he'll just put people who know what they're doing around him and then just let them run the country. And he's put absolute idiots around him, like people who have no clue, and they're running this country into the ground. And on top of that, we are turning away people who are even our own citizens, from healthcare, just basic, I think, rights. You know, we've gone backwards in terms of LGBTQ rights as well. Reversing trans protection, all sorts of stuff. I mean, we really have to think about, are we in it for ourselves or are we in it for each other? And if that argument doesn't hold, then fine. Think about yourself then. What is Trump actually going to do for you and your friends and your family? How does he actually benefit you? Let's be honest, because I think he is completely deceiving the people who are in the Rust Belt, you know, guaranteeing them jobs, which aren't there, taking credit for the jobs that they lost and then have kind of gained back temporarily. But that's not really helping them, right? In terms of social benefits and things like that, like people are voting against against their own sort of well-being, I think. So yeah, I don't know. There's just so much to be said. I mean, every day I'm just scrolling through, you know, Twitter or whatever other social media, and it's nuts. I think the people who are still supportive of Trump need to look a little, just dig a little deeper, and then also learn to read more, I think, past Breitbart or One America, which is basically you know, North Korean propaganda. So, it's my opinion.
I'm not going to push back on that opinion. I got a few responses which are pretty much similar to in fact, might be even, you know, adding some more to what you're saying. You know, speaking of, you know, you mentioned thinking about yourself, you know, in the context, think about how, what the effects are of a vote is on yourself. This is one thing I've kind of noticed, and I'm always speaking, I'll put full disclaimer, I'm speaking here from an Indian American perspective, because I've seen this among Indian Americans specifically. And it's a weird self-interest I'm noticing. So I'm first generation born here. My parents came here in the 60s and 70s, and as did a lot of their friends. So a lot of people who are my parents' generation came here in the 60s and 70s. And what's very interesting about that immigration is most, if not all of them, have preserved the India of that time. So 1970s India does not exist in India anymore, but it's still alive and kicking in the United States, right? Hmm. India has grown up so much in the past 40 years as a country, but the people who have left there for here have not. Hmm. And the reason I bring that up is because a lot of those folks who have preserved their Indian culture of 40 to 50 years ago are oddly pro-Trump, right? Yeah. And the logic is this. There's two layers to this. One is the economics of it, right? Like, you know, Republicans and Trump are good for my tax bracket, therefore I'm going to vote with my wallet. And that's kind of the belief, even though that may or may not be true. And in states like California, New Jersey, Connecticut, New York, that actually isn't true. And a lot of Indian Americans live in those states. It's been shown that the tax cuts that were mandated a few years ago actually hurt people in California and New Jersey and New York, for example. But then the second layer is, there's also this belief among Indian Americans that Trump is pro-India and anti-Pakistan. So they're voting Indian politics, not American politics. They're voting Indian politics. I'm like, wait a second, you live here in the United States. We don't mandate India-Pakistan policy. And yet you're using that as a sole basis as your vote for Trump. Like, that's literally all that they're hanging their hat on if they're not using the tax bracket analysis, right? Which also has a lot of holes in it.
Sure.
And then like, this is their weird way of saying, I am thinking about myself. I'm like, okay, but what about your kids and your grandkids who live here? Like, what about me? What about, like, I don't have kids. My sister has kids. What about her kids, right? Like, you're supporting a guy because you are stuck in the politics of your homeland from 50 years ago without thinking about the policies that will come attached with that with greater harm or effect that's going to play out much more significantly with your grandkids And do you really want to give that to them? Why did you come here? Why did you come to the United States then? If you came to give your grandkids a better life.
Yeah.
How is voting for pro-India giving your grandkids a better life in the United States? I just don't see the logic.
That is a really odd argument. I haven't actually really thought about it, but you're right. I mean, my parents, so I'm an immigrant. So I was born in Taiwan and then I came when I was 5. So, you know, I'm basically American in terms of, you know, my background. But my parents, you know, brought me here to, you know, have a better life, better opportunities and all that sort of stuff. They've since moved back to Taiwan. Actually, my dad is always, his heart and soul has kind of always been there. And my mom is an American citizen. And, you know, she was Republican and all that stuff. But I agree. I think she, and that's one of the reasons why I was Republican at first, because she was Republican. You know, it's like, that's just what my parents did. Okay, all right, I'm going to do that. And they would talk about, you know, the China policies, right? The China versus Taiwan policies, like which president or which government actually supports Taiwan more? And what are their thoughts on China? But what does that really have to do with me here necessarily? So that is an interesting perspective. I mean, I think foreign policy for sure should be something that we do think about. And it does affect us as a nation, especially for a country like China. It's like, I mean, that's just, you know, world economics right there. But, you know, for a little tiny island nation of Taiwan, which I'm very proud of, you know, in the grand scheme of things, what happens to Taiwan? Does that really matter to the U.S.? I think in some ways, you know, it does, because it has to do with fighting for democracy. But other than that, you know, it maybe doesn't have a whole lot to do with us, but it does have to do with who we are as a nation and what our character is.
Well, let me actually put this in this. I will quickly admit right now, I'm not trying to be an expert in foreign relations, let alone US, Taiwan, China relations. But I'll phrase this question this way, in terms of the effect on us. If China were to somehow invade Taiwan, where would the U.S. stand? Do you know what that answer is? Oh, I don't know. I don't know the answer.
That's a scary question to ask.
Right?
Think about it. That's true. You know, I think because of the way America is, I think it comes down to money. It really does. And China has become such a large force in the world economy that, to be honest, I think if China wanted to take over Taiwan, I think just for lip service, at least the U.S. would say, hey, don't do that. Taiwan is a democracy. We must fight for them. But I'm not sure that we want to piss off China that badly. Which does make me scared for Taiwan as a nation, which, you know, I mean, I suppose in the world, they don't even recognize Taiwan as its own country. I think it definitely is. I mean, it's completely different, right? It's not under China at all in any way, shape or form. It's not, it's its own thing. But you know, if China wants to keep making claim to it, I don't understand that. Honestly, it's just a power trip. I don't get it.
No, I don't get it either. And I agree with you. I also view Taiwan as its own country. I mean, they have their own leader. They make their own policies. They have their own legislature. The people that I know from Taiwan, I have a lot of friends who have roots from there. They identify themselves as Taiwanese. Mm-hmm. And so I would 100% stand behind Taiwan being its own independent, recognizable country. And it does baffle me why the world doesn't recognize them when it should be recognized. So 100% agree with you there. And if I could just tie in the India side of things, and I don't know how this applied to the China-Taiwan situation, but I would say, like, if India went to war with China, right? Say China and India go to battle, the United States would not jump to India's aid because we don't have a treaty with them. There is no official accord between the two countries. Yes, we get along, and yes, there are certain things that we work together from a business perspective or a policy perspective, but there isn't a formal treatise in place that declare. I mean, the U.S. has a lot of these accords with other countries, right? Where if something happens to them, like, you know, if something happens to Germany, yes, the U.S. will go in and support Germany for, as one example, right? But India does not have that, which is why I again laugh at the whole Trump is pro-India, therefore I must vote for him. I'm like, no, he's not. it's like you said, it's lip service. You know, there's nothing in place. Like, if push comes to shove, India's in trouble, the U.S. is not going to India's aid. So to make your political vote contingent upon that one thing is irresponsible, if you ask me.
Yeah.
Right?
I agree.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it is what it is, I guess. But, you know, so I'm actually part of what I'm doing here is, you know, is I'm actually starting a separate podcast series where I will talk about some of those issues and try to at least get the information out there. Right.
Yeah.
So hopefully, you know, I could have a conversation with my fellow Indian Americans and say, hey, this is what the reality is. Judge accordingly. Right. So,
yeah.
Right. So, all right, enough politics. Let's switch over to the other half of your career. I don't know if it's fair to say the other half of your career. You could kind of tell me what the balance is, but you also are in acting. You also have a stage name. So I guess let's start with revealing your stage name.
Sure. So in the acting world, I'm known as Pin Young. So you can find me on social media under Pin Young Actress on all of them, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, pretty much everything. That is my other side. My friends laughed about it sometimes because sometimes they're like, I don't know which one to tag you. Huh. Like, do I tag your music one or do I tag your acting one? It's like I'm two different people. I kind of like to keep them separate just because, you know, with my music career, it's very education focused. But with acting, that's kind of my other part of myself that I need in order to make me feel whole as a person. I can't explain it really. And it's kind of like, you know, a lot of actors say like, oh, I caught the acting bug and that's just it. And that is kind of what happened to me. But I also know that my main goal in this world is music, you know, is to spread the love of music to as many people as possible. But personally, you know, my own personal fulfillment, I need that acting in order to feel whole. And part of that also comes with just sort of the performative aspect of it. As a conductor, I take on the personality of the music. And so that's already sort of an aspect of acting. And then the actual being an actor just puts words and emotions and being in front of a camera. And one of my, well, I guess my life sort of mantra and motto is to truly affect people. And when I was a kid, one of the things that I had aspired to be when I grew up was a clown. And it was because I wanted to make people laugh for a living. I just found that to be really valuable, you know, and I got a lot of personal joy out of it. And so that's what that kind of fulfills for me, is the acting part is me being able to take on another sort of persona. And it just, it's like playing, you know, it's fun. That's actually how I met Jesse, the friend that connected us. We were in the same acting class together down in San Diego. And so now I do that in my free time. So I wouldn't say it's half of my career. Most of my career is focused on music and music education. But the acting part of it, at first I thought it was just going to be a hobby. It's like, oh, I've always kind of wanted to do it ever since I was a kid. And my parents didn't want me to do it because they thought that was, you know... don't get into the entertainment industry, you're going to become a bad person. So they never let me take drama or theater or anything. I was able to get away with musical theater because that was music. But what actually happened in high school was my first year I was in the pit orchestra playing violin, and I was like, oh, that looks way more fun on stage. So the next 3 years I was in the cast instead. Much to the dismay of my music teacher, but I joined the cast instead, and then basically once I was an adult, after I got out of college, I'm like, hey, I'm making my own money. So I kind of did the thing that, you know, I think we were talking about with adults taking on, you know, a musical instrument afterwards because they're like, okay, I can do this. Well, that's what I did with acting. It was like, you know what? I'm an adult. I'm going to do what I want. So I started taking acting classes, and then my acting coach said, hey, you should go out and audition and actually like go and do projects and get paid for them. I'm like, oh no, it's okay. I just, you know, it's a hobby. I'm fine. It's like, no, you should go audition. So it's like, okay, fine. I'll try it out. And I ended up booking the first thing that I auditioned for, which was pretty exhilarating. Like, who does that? And then after that, I was like, what? Wait, I can get paid for this? This is okay, sure, why not? And so that started many, many years ago. And you know, ever since I've dipped my toes in every once in a while when I have time. You know, when I started Crescendo Young Musicians Guild, I kind of started to run out of some of that free time. So I took a really long hiatus from acting, but with the quarantine I actually really started to dive in a lot more. So I've been been able to, especially with the quarantine now, it's kind of worked out to my advantage because there are very few in-person auditions. So I'm able to do mostly self-tapes from home and book gigs that way. So it's kind of nice.
Really nice. And thank you for that wonderful summary. You did such a good job of summarizing your acting. I actually don't have a follow-up to all that. Which, if you knew me, you know that's pretty rare, because I could ask questions for days. So the fact that I don't have one to ask right now is kind of baffling, but also a credit to you. So good job acting, I guess. So what's next for you? I mean, you know, we talked about kind of your journey too here. What's the future of Pin Chen / Pin Young look like?
So, I mean, the future is, well, none of us really know what the future holds with this pandemic right now. But the plan, I think, still is, you know, I will still keep doing as much as I can to reach as many kids in terms of music education and providing those opportunities for students through, you know, my school, through the youth orchestra, you know, Pasadena Youth Symphony, and through Crescendo Young Musicians Guild, and just keep trekking on that way. That occupies, you know, a whole ton of time, and especially with the online education right now is taking up way more time than I had expected, coming up with ways to still be an orchestra online. And of course, you know, eventually I hope to go back to normal, and be able to be in front of kids and making music with them that way. And then with the acting thing, you know, it's really, ever since, you know, I think March, it's really reinvigorated my love for acting. I guess I'm just a happier person when I get to do it. And so I still need to just remember that I need that, and to continue working at it. And the climate, actually, honestly, for Asian American actors now is so much different than when I first started back in, gosh, when did I start acting? what was that, 2005 maybe ish, something like that. So, you know, I've kind of been in and out of it for about 15 years. And before, I wouldn't have even imagined that it could be possible for me to be in a commercial or, you know, or be in a TV show, you know. And if I am in a TV show, it would just be as like an Asian waitress in, you know, with a one-liner, you know. And nowadays, it's like, we're kind of like everywhere now, which is very, very exciting. And so I think you know, I'm just going to keep keep on doing that and see what opportunities come to me, and taking classes, working on my craft, you know, with my Instagram and YouTube account, I've been posting every once in a while some, you know, scenes and monologues just to kind of keep things alive, and still doing auditions on my own. So I'm just going to, you know, keep on kind of doing what I have been doing, and aspire to be able to take advantage of whatever gigs seem to come my way.
Well, Godspeed to all of that, and we'll definitely, you know, we'll support you here at the Asian Highway. So best of fortune on everything ahead of you. And, you know, obviously you almost opened the Pandora's box for me now, because I'd love to have a separate conversation with you now in another episode about how Asian Americans have evolved in Hollywood these past 15 years, because I've been, as a journalist, I've worked in and out of Hollywood, you know, reporting on stuff for the past 12 years. So I've got to witness, as a journalist, kind of some of the evolution. And, you know, I started, I think my first foray into Hollywood as a journalist was in 07. So a couple of years after you got started. And around that time was when Slumdog Millionaire came out. Mm. And I remember the state of Indian Americans in Hollywood at the time. And you had you said you had the waitress with the one-liner role, you know, in a commercial role. You know, the roles that Indian Americans would get was, you know, taxi driver or terrorist, or it was limitation of the roles that are available to them. Without realizing, I think this applies to all of Asian American groups, is none of us are a monolith, right? I mean, Chinese Americans, Taiwanese Americans, Japanese Americans, Korean Americans, Indian Americans, all of us are diverse within our own rights, right? And for Hollywood to only select one or two of those things, at least, you know, several years ago, this was kind of doing ourselves a disservice. But it's kind of been great to see that now we're seeing more and more roles open up for us. There's a film opening up next Friday online where it's an Indian American as the lead, and it's a nationwide release. So, you know, we're starting to see more, and, you know, we're seeing Mulan came out recently, which is an all Chinese cast, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's, at least for me, in my casual observation, as a looking from the outside in, it seems like there's progress. So I'd love to have a conversation with you separately, another episode, about what that progress really looks like, and is it real? Are we getting somewhere? You don't have to answer that now.
Oh yeah, as you were talking, I was already like, oh yeah, mm-hmm, there's this, and this.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, because yes, there's progress, but, you know, like, when you put all the Asian people into one film, is that progress?
Not really. I mean, and, right. And that's why that's why this is a bigger conversation, right? That's exactly why this is a big conversation, because there's no way in this 2 minutes talk about this we could capture the essence of what's really going on. It looks like progress, but is it really? And and there, let's be honest, so none of us are naive about this. There's a lot of work that still needs to be done. We're nowhere near where we need to be right now, and we have to acknowledge that. I mean, I think, like I said, anybody is naive that thinks that way, that we're fine now. We're not. So we'll have to have a separate chat. I would love to have you back on just to talk about that.
I would love that.
Yeah. So Pin, let's wrap it up real quick. This is the first where I'm going to ask you to give us where to find you for two names. Where can we find Pin Chen, and where can we find Pin Young? Online, your websites, give us a little line.
Sure. Okay. So my music site is all Pin Chen Music, PINCHEN Music. So that's my handle for, I think I mostly am active on, I guess, Instagram more or less for Pin Chen Music. And then, for my website, it's also pinchenmusic.com. And then for the acting part, I'm a lot more active, just because, you know, the nature of things, you kind of have to be a little bit more active. So Pin Young Actress, that's, you can find me there for YouTube, Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And I would love to connect with all of you guys in either or, and all of the following platforms. I love to just meet new people and connect. And especially, you know, if you have, gigs that perhaps, you know, on the music side of things that you think our young musicians could be a part of. You know, we love to go out and perform and serve the community. We always send them out to go to like hospitals and assisted living facilities, not so much right now, but in the future, and charity fundraisers, just giving kids a way to share their music with others. I'm always looking out for ways to basically make their experience a little bit more whole and be able to utilize the learning that they are getting. And then for the acting part of things, I love doing, you know, comedic roles, dramatic roles, basically anything. So, yeah, if you got a project, I would love to hear about it and would love an opportunity.
Excellent. Like I said, we'll do what we can to promote you as much as we can on our end. So looking forward to hopefully getting you connected to some people. Real quick, on our end, you could obviously find The Asian Highway and Storytellers in Action on those same platforms. If you're on Facebook or Instagram or Twitter, just look up The Asian Highway and you'll find us. The podcast itself, Storytellers in Action, is on all platforms. You'll find us on Apple, on Google Play, on iHeartRadio, Spotify, and everywhere else you find your podcasts. Just search for Storytellers in Action. And you'll find all of our episodes. This is, like I said, season 5, episode 5. We have 55 episodes. Wow, it's a 5-5-5-5 kind of day for us. Five's your lucky number, Pin.
Woo-hoo! Yeah.
Pin, this was a riveting conversation. This was long, but great. I mean, this is one of the few times I actually enjoy the conversation, and I don't want to end it.
Oh,
so
man.
I wish we could keep going, but... it's just more reason for us to have you back in studio once we actually are in studio. And to everyone listening to the episode, you know, we're doing this on Zoom. We're doing this remotely, and you can't see, but I can. Pin has this great background. It's a Star Wars background. I believe it's the Millennium Falcon.
No, it is not, actually.
It is not? Oh, I'm wrong. Okay. Okay, describe. Where are we? Are we in the Death Star?
You know what? To be honest, this is on one of the bad people's, the dark side ships, but this is definitely not the Millennium Falcon. I do have one, or I have a couple of them that are on the Millennium Falcon, but this is not one of them.
Nice. Well,
you know what? I could take a screenshot and I'll send this over to you.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So definitely, you know, you take your screenshot first. I'll take mine. It's kind of weird that we're talking about this while we're recording, and I'm not going to edit this out. let's have the people listen how much fun we're having talking. Right?
All right.
I'm ready when you are.
Ready? All right. Awesome.
All right. Yeah. So, please send that to me because I'll use that.
Do.
If you can send that to me today, I'll definitely use that for the promo. So you hear that, people? We're promoting.
Woo!
All right, Pin. Well, this is a great conversation and best of fortune in everything you're doing. And keep doing what you're doing. It's great stuff. We really respect all you're doing. So thank you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. This was tons of fun.
All right. And on behalf of everybody here at the Asian Highway, on behalf of Dabesh and Ferial, this is Kimo signing off. We'll talk to you next week.